This is the podcast Surgery ICU Rounds. My name's Jeff Guy. Today is Saturday, March the 9th, 2008. The topic that I want to talk about today is something that gets mentioned frequently on rounds, and I'm not exactly sure that everyone who's rounding with us really has an understanding of the importance of this topic, and that is drug-induced QT prolongation. You may also hear this sometimes called as prolonged QT syndrome. Drug-induced long QT syndrome is typically characterized by an acquired QT interval prolongation, which results in the increased likelihood of a patient developing the cardiac arrhythmia Torsades-Dupont's. For those of you who don't know what Torsades is a Y-complex arrhythmia that often looks like a coarse ventricular fibrillation. And it appears that these wide QRS complexes twist around a central line, almost like in a sinusoidal-type fashion. This Torsades-Dupont's is usually self-limited, but can degenerate into ventricular fibrillation and, obviously, sudden cardiac death. A variety of medications, and many of these are common medications, have been implicated in drug-induced long QT syndrome. And, in fact, QT prolongation and the development of Torsades are the most common reasons drugs are restricted or removed from the market within the United States. And the reference for that is Lasser and colleagues in the Journal of the American Medical Association in the year 2002. Let's start our discussion by actually detailing what is a QT interval and how is it measured. When one looks at an EKG tracing, the QT interval is that interval that really measures from the point where the ventricle is depolarized and through the point where the ventricle is repolarized. And if you're looking at an EKG tracing, this is from the point of the start of the QRS complex to the end of the T wave. Now, in the normal individual, the QT intervals will vary for a variety of reasons. We can see variations throughout the day, secondary to diurnal effects. Electrolyte imbalances may cause changes in the QT interval, autonomic fluctuations, and even the way the EKG is acquired, the technician places the leads. QT intervals can be shortened with increasing heart rate and tachycardia, and can be lengthened with bradycardia. And therefore, since we have a lot of variation of the QT interval between individuals as well as within an interval, as well as within a particular individual, we have what's known as a corrected QT interval. And when you look at an EKG, this will often be recorded as a QT with a lowercase c. And this is a corrected QT interval, and we calculate it. Bizet, in an article in Heart in 1920, actually characterized or detailed a way of the determination of a corrected QT interval. And the corrected QT interval is determined by dividing the longest QT interval by the square root of the RR interval. There's really no consensus as to which is the best method of determining a corrected QT interval, but this method described by Bizet in the 1920s really appears to remain the gold standard for determination of the corrected QT interval. So when we look at the EKG and we see this capital Q, capital T, and a small case C, what is really an acceptable corrected QT interval? Well, anything less than 440 milliseconds is clearly normal. Once you get above 440, you start to get into a gray zone, and where the QT interval, the corrected QT interval, is not normal. And there are differences of the corrected QT interval based on gender. For men, between 440 to 460 are considered borderline, and in women, a borderline QT interval is between 440 to 470 milliseconds. What is clearly agreed upon is that women will have longer corrected QT intervals than men. Now, this is one of those things that I think is really interesting to look at in intensive care units, because often people will get screening EKGs and they're looking for any kind of evidence of previous myocardial ischemia, or an EKG is obtained because a patient's having hypoxia or hypotension or chest pain, and we're looking for something acute that will change or initiate a therapy immediately. But often a patient will may come to the intensive care unit. I really think it is really part of the ICU admission process that when we look at these EKGs, we really need to be mindful of what this corrected QT interval is, as we should certainly be considerate of the medications that we use for a variety of medical conditions that may be complicated by a prolonged QT interval. Now let's just go back and review just some of the few things we've already talked about, that what a QT interval on an EKG represents physiologically is the process of cardiac depolarization followed by the cardiac repolarization. So if you imagine the heart going through its motions, it's the firing and reloading of the electrophysiology of the heart. In that when we have a prolonged corrected QT interval, our patients are at increased risk of developing the fatal, potentially fatal arrhythmia of torsades de pons and deteriorating into ventricular fibrillation or sudden cardiac death based on the usage of medications that are commonly used in intensive care units. And when you get into the underlying physiology of why we have problems with prolonged QT syndrome and the development of torsades, it appears to be primarily mediated by the efflux of potassium ions. Now, not everyone who has a prolonged QT is going to develop torsades, and in fact, many patients with marked prolonged QT never develop torsades, although there are other patients who develop torsades with only minimal prolongation of their corrected QT interval. The literature has several other types of methods or evaluations of the EKG that are used to try to predict patients who may be at risk for the development of torsades de pons. These include things like something called a QT dispersion, QT intervals, and even something called T-peak to T-end measurements. But despite all of these other evaluations of the EKG, and many of them may be very promising, the QT prolongation remains the most useful clinical tool at present to predict the risk of the development of torsades de pons. Well, what are some of the risk factors for patients treated with prolonging QT medications, and why do some patients perhaps will develop torsades and others won't? Well, there are several risk factors that will predispose patients to drug-induced long QT syndrome and the development of torsades. Zeltzer and colleagues evaluated 245 incidents of torsades de pons due to non-cardiac medications, and virtually all the patients who suffered from torsades had at least one risk factor, and 71% of those patients had multiple risk factors. Well, some of these risk factors, well, female sex was the most common risk factor and was present in 71% of the patients. Other common risk factors included structural heart disease, and this includes things such as myocardial infarction, patients who have heart failure, valvular heart disease, and patients with cardiomyopathy. Patients who had hypokalemia, patients who are on multiple QT prolonging medications or drugs that may interfere with the metabolism of those medications also were considered risk factors. And then of course, there are those patients who had prolonged baseline of their corrected QT, and in this particular evaluation, that was with a QT interval, a corrected QT interval of greater than 450 milliseconds. There are clearly those patients who have a family history or congenital long QT syndrome and prior drug-induced torsades de pons. Other potential risk factors include hepatic impairment, bradycardia, atrial ventricular block, were also considered risk factors. So you can see that some of these are a little bit more specific as far as risk factors for torsades, but some of them are very common. I mean, namely a female gender, people who have what's considered a structural heart defect in the form of myocardial ischemia or heart failure or cardiomyopathy. There are some classes of genes that have been looked at as predisposing folks to the development of a prolonged QT, as well as genetic polymorphisms. And those are topics that if you're interested in, I would certainly recommend you delve into the literature, but a little bit more than I want to get into in this particular podcast. But the thing that we really need to recognize is that there are identified medications that in standard practice in intensive care units, that if you identify somebody who has a long QT syndrome, you should certainly give pause as to what medications you are prescribing, and certainly give review of the patient's medication list, looking for things that may aggravate the long QT syndrome and maybe perhaps be responsible for degeneration into a potentially malignant arrhythm. Now, some of these medications will prolong the corrected QT syndrome and induce torsades in a dose-dependent manner. So it's just not the fact that you have the patient on the medication, but as you go up on the doses, your actual risk for the development of prolongation of the corrected QT and the development of torsades actually increases. And this is because you're interacting with the potassium channel blockade. And as we said earlier, that, you know, as we went into a cursory explanation as why patients will develop a prolonged QT, is that this mechanism appears to be mediated by potassium efflux. Well, one class of drugs, we look at the classes of drugs that are typically associated with prolongation of the QT interval, are drugs like antiarrhythmics, promotility drugs, antimicrobial drugs, psychiatric medications, as well as some analgesics, namely methadone. Now, let's first focus on the antiarrhythmics. Now, the torsades de pons in this case is most commonly caused by the antiarrhythmic medications. Patients taking these commonly will have organic heart disease, otherwise they typically would not be on an antiarrhythmic. And they often will take diuretics. The diuretics, as you know, will cause hypokalemia, and we've already said that hypokalemia is one of those risk factors that will develop in the torsades. Remember that we said that patients who had a prolonged corrected QT syndrome that developed torsades, they frequently had the presence of one risk factor, and many of them had the risk of multiple risk factors. So in this case, you could have a patient has a heart injury from myocardial ischemia or cardiomyopathy. They may have female gender. You put them on a diuretic, you induce hypokalemia, and you create by the hypokalemia an additional risk factor. Class 1A drugs in the antiarrhythmics typically include things like quinidine or procainamide. Procainamide is probably not used nearly as much today as it was used 10, 15 years ago, but it is still a drug that is used. It's a very good drug. And the thing with procainamide is that procainamide, compared to the other drugs that are considered class 1A antiarrhythmics, procainamide is less likely to cause torsades. But when we use procainamide, remember we do have a metabolite that we monitor for, and that's acetylprocainamide, or what we typically will call NAPA levels. And that NAPA level has the potential to interfere with the potassium effluxing properties of the cell, and remember that that is the principal mechanism why we see prolongation of the QT interval, and therefore the patient is at increased risk for the development of torsades as the patient will develop higher NAPA levels. Now, this is particularly important in a patient who has altering renal function, because as a patient's renal function becomes impaired, they will develop higher levels of NAPA levels, and therefore perhaps predispose or increase the risk that the patient can experience an increase in their prolonged QT and or the development of torsades if they already have a prolonged QT. Now, class 3 antiarrhythmics are also very potent blockers of potassium efflux, and they will prolong the corrected QT interval in a dose-dependent manner. So the higher doses you go with these drugs, the higher you'll see that prolongation of the corrected QT interval. An example of a class 3 antiarrhythmic is sotalol, and these drugs will actually block the potassium efflux most effectively at low heart rates, and therefore this gets into something called a reverse use dependency phenomena. And therefore, as you're giving these drugs like Sotalol, the risk of torsades actually increases with bradycardia, which seems kind of paradoxical that your risk of a rhythm that looks like a V-fib is actually increased in a situation where we're slowing the heart rate down. And for Sotalol, the risk of torsades ranges from 0.8 to 3.8%. According to an article published by Lazara in the European Heart Journal back in 1993. And we see similar rates for the development of torsades with the other class 3 antiarrhythmics. Intravenous ibutylide has caused torsades, and it's been reported an occurrence rate of 3.6 to 8.3%, so significantly higher when administered for conversion of atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter. And the reference for that would be an article by Ellen Bogan and colleagues in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology back in 1996. Now, amiodarone is a very popular drug. It's a drug that I like a significant amount of, and it is unlikely to cause torsades de pons despite a significant QT prolongation. And the incidence of torsades with the use of amiodarone at currently recommended doses is less than 1%. Now let's go back and review some of the other medications or classes of medications that can cause prolongation of the corrected QT interval, and that's namely the promotility medications. There was a drug that was used very widely in the late 90s, a drug called cisapride, and it was used to treat gastroesophageal reflux disease and other conditions where patients needed a promotility agent, and it actually caused about 341 cases of prolongation of the QT, ventricular arrhythmias, or cardiac arrest that were reported to the Food and Drug Administration between the six-year period of 1993 to 1999. And therefore, in the year 2000, cisapride was removed from marketing within the United States. Drugs that are commonly used within the intensive care unit are antibiotics. We use a significant amount of antibiotics, unfortunately. And macrolide antibiotics such as erythromycin have been implicated in sudden cardiac death secondary to torsades de pons. And also erythromycin, you know, since cisapride was taken away as a promotility agent, people will typically use erythromycin as a motilin analog. So you've taken away the cisapride because of its problems with promotility as a promotility agent, and then we replace that with erythromycin, and we have similar, some of the same adverse effects. Some fluoroquinolones have been implicated as well as sporadic incidents of development of torsades, but the overall incidence of fluoroquinolone-induced torsades de pons secondary to a prolongation of the QT is very low. And according to several papers, there's really no evidence that currently available fluoroquinolones cause the development of torsades de pons without underlying risk factors. So go back and review what those risk factors were when we talk about people who had heart disease, female family history, congenital long QT, and previous anti-protozoan drugs and antifungal drugs have also been implicated in QT prolongation and the development of torsades. Probably the most notable is betamidine. Some of the antifungals that are associated with the development of torsades include the ones such as we use frequently, such as fluconazole, itraconazole, ketoconazole, and voriconazole. And again, these are unlikely result in the development of torsades unless the patient has some sort of pre-existing risk factors. So again, the scenario that I would go back on is if you're admitting a patient to the intensive care unit, you need to do not only a thorough physical examination, but your history also needs to look at, do they have any kind of family history of sudden cardiac death? What is their, you know, QT interval, and corrected QT interval on the EKG? And then really determine, are those medications being used to treat a specific infection, or are they being used empirically? Another class of drugs that gets used reasonably frequently in intensive care units are some psychiatric drugs. Phenothiazine classes, as well as drugs such as droperidol and Haldol, have all been documented to result in the development of torsades in somebody who has a prolonged QT. Riley and colleagues in the journal Lancet in 2000 reported that about 8% of 495 psychiatric patients receiving medications had QT prolongation. Thioridazine and droperidol pose the highest risks. QT prolongation has also been noted in patients receiving tricyclic antidepressants. And once again, it's usually not that it's isolated in patients just receiving the medication, but patients who had prolongation of the QT receiving the medication and with additional risk factors. Lastly, one of the medications that we use significantly in our intensive care unit is the drug methadone. Methadone is a very effective, long-acting oral narcotic that we can give down the NG tube. It's also used probably... what people are most familiar with it, probably secondary to television, is treatment for heroin addiction. But like I said, it's great for the use of chronic pain. Methadone does block some of the potassium cells and potassium efflux, and therefore has the ability to prolong the corrected QT interval, and again in a dose-dependent fashion. Now, in the 33 years between 1969 and 2002, 59 cases of methadone-induced long QT syndrome or torsades were reported to the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. So that's a very good track record for that medication. And of those cases, additional risk factor was found in 75% of the cases. There are some vitamins that are associated with the development of prolonged QT and torsades, cesium, licorice have also been implicated. Extracts from licorice, grapefruit juice, olive leaves, and red grape skins also inhibit some of the mechanisms by which medications that do prolong the QT interval are metabolized. There are long, long lists of medications besides the ones we mentioned here that will result in a prolongation of the QT or corrected QT. And some of them that we didn't mention, some antihypertensive medications such as diltiazem, nifedipine, and verapamil are inhibitors of the metabolism pathway of many of the drugs that are implicated in torsades. Midazolam, or Versed, is also an inhibitor of the metabolic pathways. It is impractical for any one individual to maintain in their memory all of the medications that can result in a prolonged QT interval. And we'll typically do a Google search for prolonged QT websites, and there are several that are out there. The University of Arizona certainly maintains what I think is a great database of drugs that will result in prolongation of the QT. And some of these websites, I'm going to list these off, are www.torsades.org, www.qtdrugs.org, www.longqt.org, and www.sads.org. So finally, as a simple review as to what do you do if your patient is getting one of these drugs, they do have a prolonged corrected QT, and the rhythm does degenerate into a torsades, well, you simply have to follow the algorithms put forward by the American Heart Association and ACLS, and the treatment for torsades is intravenous magnesium sulfate. Typically, you give 2 grams of an IV bolus followed by an infusion of 2 to 4 milligrams per minute. As we said, the hypokalemia will predispose someone and is considered a risk factor for the development of torsades. So obviously you want to give the patient supplemental potassium to get potassium between 4.5 to 5. And any medication that is known to prolong the QT or interfere with those drugs' metabolism needs to be discontinued. Overdrive transvenous pacing will certainly shorten the QT and is highly effective in preventing its recurrence. and should be certainly could be considered in cases where the patient is refractory to the magnesium, or in cases where the torsades is precipitated by cardiac pause or bradycardia. If you don't have temporary pacing available, or while you're trying to get ready for transvenous pacing, isoprel or isoproterenol is a consideration. But isoproterenol is contraindicated in patients who have a congenital long QT syndrome or in patients who have ischemic heart disease because of its ability to increase myocardial oxygen consumption. That concludes this very brief talk on drug-induced QT prolongation. I hope this provides some light into what seems certainly for our residents sometimes to be a rather nebulous a problem that, in my opinion, gets overlooked all too often in the intensive care unit. You've been listening to the podcast Surgery ICU Rounds. My name is Jeff Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery at Vanderbilt University Medical Center and director of the Burn Center there. Our website is www.burndoc.com. The formal burn units website is www.vuburncenter.com, and all of these podcasts are archived on the website www.icurounds.com. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.